So this morning, we are jumping right back into the series Called to Crossover, which we were in before we did our little mini-series of the parables of Jesus and the Gospel of Luke. And so we're jumping back into something that we have been in for a while, but it's been a while, so we kind of need to get reacclimated with where we have been in order to properly understand what we're going to be examining today. If you recall, the last time we were in Abe's story, and I playfully call him Abe because I feel like I've gotten to know him so well. He's not Abram or Abraham to me. He's just Abe. All of his failures, all of his strengths, all of his weaknesses, all of his victories. So last time we looked at Abraham's story, he was visited by these unexpected heavenly messengers, a couple of angels and the Lord. And it's on the heels of that revealing conversation that Abraham received from those men. They told him, listen, we are going down to Sodom and we are going to bring God's justice and God's judgment there because the cry of the people is so great. So it's on the heels of that. We have to make sure we connect these two things together because they are intended to be connected together for very explicit purposes, which we will get into. Abraham knows that these angels are traveling to deliver judgment, and his biggest concern at the time was whether the righteous would be swept away with the wicked. Specifically, would his nephew Lot, who, if you recall, is much more like a son than a nephew because Abraham and Sarah yet have no children, will Lot and his family be swept away in this judgment? So today, we see the execution of that judgment by these angelic visitors, and we're going to learn, I think, something about the dark power of sin and temptation. We're going to look at Lot's life and his obedience or lack thereof, and then we're going to finish up at the end by seeing something that God has to teach us through the eyes and the person of Abraham. So let's jump right in. Genesis chapter 19, starting in verse 1, all the way to verse 29. It is a marathon today. Marathon. You guys will be lucky to be out of here by 2:30. Just remember that. Here we go, Genesis 19, starting in verse 1. The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. And when he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. My lords, he said, please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night, and then go on your way early in the morning. No, they answered, we will spend the night in the square. But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him, and he entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you at night? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them. And Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him. And he said, no, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you and you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof. Get out of our way, they replied. This fellow, he came here as a foreigner and now he wants to play the judge? We'll treat you worse than them. They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. And then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so they could not find the door. The two men said to Lot, do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, daughters, sons or daughters, anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against his people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were pledged to be married to his daughters. And he said, hurry, get out of this place because the Lord is about to destroy the city. But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. With the coming of the dawn, the angels urged Lot saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here or you will be swept away when the city is punished. When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. And as soon as they brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives. Don't look back. Don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away. But Lot said to them, no, my lords, please, your servant has found favor in your eyes and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life. but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me and I'll die. Look, here's a town near enough to run to. It's very small. Let me flee to it. It's very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared. And he said to him, very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee there quickly because I cannot do anything until you reach it. And that is why the town was called Zoar. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. And the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land on the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land, like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. And so I've given the sermon the title, Leave or Perish. Leave or Perish. And as I was reading the warnings and reading about the fire falling from heaven, I couldn't help but think of Japan towards the end of World War II, before those two nuclear bombs were dropped on those two cities. It's told that there were leaflets that were dropped from the air to multiple cities in Japan, warning them that something was coming, something terrible was coming. Now, they didn't list the cities by name, but they promised that there would be, quote, prompt and utter destruction. The president even said there would be a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. And people were warned, leave or perish. And of course, you know the rest of the story. But Lot receives a similar warning from these messengers, leave or perish. And we have to ask the questions, what do we learn from Lot's experience? What do we learn from the destruction of the cities on the plain of Sodom and Gomorrah? So three things, three big ideas that I would love for you to take away from all of this morning. And there is so much. Listen, I could have preached three or four sermons just on this passage, but we're plodding through Genesis and we're going to tackle as much as we can today. Here's the first thing. Sin is never simple. Sin is never simple. Now, before I go any further, I have to say this. Of course, in a sense, sin is very simple, right? Sin is falling short of God's calling for what your life should look like, what my life should look like. Anytime our attitudes, our actions, our thoughts, our desires, anytime they are out of line from what God desires, it's very simple. That is sin. One of the words in the New Testament to describe that condition is actually an old archery term that they adopted in. An archer would use the arrows, and any arrow that did not hit the center of the target would be said to have fallen short. So in a sense, yes, sin is simple in that one sense. But I would submit to you today that if we read this story, we'll see that sin is actually never really simple when we look deeper. In this passage, it looks like the sin of Sodom is simple. But what is true is that only one portion or one layer of the sin of Sodom is evident. It's as if it's the tip of the iceberg, as it were. There's a lot of iceberg underneath. We are seeing the tip of the iceberg explicitly here in this story, right? So that's the first thing that's obvious. It's obvious that the sexual sin that this city is characterized with is one of the ways in which God has said, this cannot be tolerated. Right? The words, the attitudes, the actions of the crowd outside of Lot's door are self-evident. And did you notice the comprehensive nature of those attitudes? We're told that they applied to all the men of every part of the city, young and old. Something that ran throughout was woven into the fabric of the community. You might wonder, well, what about the ladies? Well, sadly, we're working with a culture where women, frankly, just didn't matter as much as men. And secondly, it would be assumed that they would have simply adopted whatever attitudes the men would have had. So that's everyone. That is the top layer, the tip of the iceberg. But there is more here, because sin is never simple. Here's the second thing. What the original story makes clear when we read it and understand it in its context, like I said earlier, tying it back to Abraham's story earlier, there's another layer of sin that is present here that would have been blatantly obvious to the story's earliest listeners, and that is the absence of hospitality and the mistreatment of strangers. Now, I say it would have been blatantly obvious to them, even if it's not to us, and I want to explain why. Being inhospitable in the ancient world would have been considered a red level manifestation of a sinful heart or a sinful community. If you did not treat visitors, guests with care, to them it was like a huge deal. This was not a small thing. And the theme of sinfully poor hospitality is woven very deeply into this story. It starts in the square when those guests show up. And who's the only person to offer lodging? It's Lot. No one else in the square, which in the square at that time in that culture, during that time of day in the evening, it would be the time that the elders of the community would get together to settle disputes. If anyone had a problem or a complaint or there was two people going at it, they would come to the city square in the evening. The elders, the most influential people in the community, the most powerful people, would be there to settle the dispute for them. And how many of them offer hospitality, housing, a meal for these guests? None of them do. Only Lot. That lack of hospitality is further amplified when we remember the episode just before this one, because in chapter 18, Abraham was visited by these same strangers, and how did he react to having them there? He showered them with an abundance of kindness. Of course, on the front end, he said, just stay for a little bread. Just stay for a little bread. And once they agreed, he said, you know, kick back, relax. I'm gonna get the finest cut of steak I can find from all of my herds. He served them that rich yogurty dessert. Like, he brought everything out. He pulled all the stops. And when you look and you compare that to what Lot offers the people, even though he's the one who actually offers to bring them in, it's evident. Now, we might not see this deep connection at first for a variety of reasons, but I would say that one of them, maybe the biggest one, is that in an individualistic culture, we have effectively unlearned hospitality. In the individualistic world in which we live today, we have very effectively unlearned hospitality. That's why when we look at a story like this, it doesn't light up for us the way it might have for those ancient readers. Now, you might say, what do you mean we've unlearned hospitality? I'm nice to people, right? But think about it for a second. I mean, there are evidences that this is true. Here's the first one. I love driving through the city of Salem, especially going through some of the older sections where they have the older homes that are 70, 80, 100 years old or more. And if you drive past those homes and you look at them from the road, nearly all of them share one very distinguishing feature. They have gigantic porches on the front. Huge porches on the front of those old houses. Now, fast forward, and in the houses that we're building today, if you drive through a newer development, how many of those houses actually have porches on them at all? Mostly it's just a front stoop where the door is. If they have a porch, it's probably rather small and just really for decoration. And I'm preaching at the choir to myself, like, we have a porch, and I can't tell you the amount of times I've just sat on my porch. It's not very many. There used to be a day in generations past where you would sit on your porch because that was part of what it meant to be a good neighbor and be hospitable with the people around you. But we don't build big porches anymore. But what do we build? On the back of the houses. Gigantic decks. Right? Just evidence that we have started to unlearn what it means to be hospitable and neighborly. I've made this point before, and I'll make it again. Generations ago, if you were home and dinner was just finishing up and you heard the doorbell ring, that made your night. You got excited. You raced the entire family to see who was at the door. You got out the fruitcake and the tea or whatever you had and the fine china. Guests were there, and it was an exciting time. These days, especially in younger generations, again, speaking from experience, that doorbell rings or the knock comes, and the first thing you do is go, did you call? Are you expecting someone? Did you call? Or do you know somebody's coming? And you whisper. You really do whisper because you think if they can't hear you and you slink back to the back part of the house, they might not think you're home. because we've unlearned what it means to be hospitable. Porches to decks, excitement to fear. And how about this one? Just be honest. I'm not going to ask you to answer out loud, but how many of you have known you're having family come in for an extended time, weekend, maybe a week, and you're on the phone making plans, and eventually the party on the other line says, you know what, I think we're just going to go ahead and get a hotel. And you breathe a sigh of relief, don't you? You don't have to answer. But it's evidence that we are unlearning or have unlearned hospitality. And so when we see a violation of it here in Scripture, we don't see it as clearly as those original readers and listeners would have seen it. So that's another layer. You have the obvious sexual immorality sin, then you have this complete lack of hospitality, which in their day would have been a huge red level thing, and then you have this. We learn from the testimony of Scripture itself that it goes even beyond those two things, and we learn about it in Ezekiel chapter 16. Listen to these words. Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me, and therefore I did away with them as you have seen. The mention of the detestable things is probably what correlates to the iceberg we've seen in Genesis itself, but did you notice it's not the only thing that's listed? There are so many more layers there. Arrogance, gluttony, and what I would call pompous superiority. That word in the Hebrew of haughtiness is kind of hard to grapple with in English, but I think pompous superiority is a good way of putting it. And then a lack of care for the disadvantaged among them. Those were the things that God saw. Those were the crying out that he heard. I read one commentator this week who put it this way: the list of Sodom's sins here in Ezekiel 16 highlights the city's arrogance or pride in materialistic comfort and excess, coupled with a lack of concern for the poor. So if you read Genesis 18 and we don't read it with a fuller understanding, we tend to look at the tip of the iceberg without understanding. There are so many layers, so many levels of what is going on, of the things God saw, and the reason that he heard an outcry from the people and felt it was time to go down and to care for bringing justice and judgment. So I would say a couple things in response to all of these layers. First of all, our struggle with sin is almost never about just one thing. Because if we read on the surface of Genesis 18, it seems like we can be like, yeah, just one thing. But if you look in Ezekiel and you look, it's not just one thing. And your sin, in our lives, it's not about just one thing. Have you ever fallen into that trap? I have. If I get just this one thing straightened out, it'll be good. But it's not true. It's not true because as individuals, we are complex and multi-layered people. It shouldn't surprise us that our struggle with sin looks similar to that. Now, the remedy for our sin is a singular and simple solution, the cross and resurrection of Jesus. But our day-to-day struggle against the flesh and the world and the enemy is a multi-front conflict. Don't get in the trap of, I just need to get this one thing straightened out. Because you'll be very disappointed when the next one thing comes at you. And I would say this secondly. We are much more Sodomites than we realize, probably. And I say that because we may feel safe from God's judgment if we've never struggled with the sexual sin of some kind that is represented here in this passage. And we breathe a sigh of relief. Whew, okay. But we have to ask the question then, are we prideful people? Are we overfed people while our neighbors go hungry? Do we view the world through a lens of self-induced moral exceptionality? And by that I mean, I am better than that person. My group is better than that group over there. My neighborhood is better than that neighborhood. My nation is better than that nation. If we look through that lens, then we're probably more Sodomites than we realize. And do the poor and the needy among us go ignored or unhelped? Because if any of those things are true, guess what, my friends? To riff on an old Jeff Foxworthy line, you might be a Sodomite. His famous line, you might be a redneck if, well listen, if you look at what's unpacked here in Ezekiel and what's happening in Genesis 18, at least I know I realized, wow, I am overfed. I can see arrogance and pride in my life and in my culture, for sure. Sin is never simple, and here's the second one. Obedience is never perfect. Obedience is never perfect. Because taken as a whole, especially when we join it with the rest of the chapter, and we're going to get to that next week, and it's just as messed up, even or more so than today, so looking forward to that. But the focal point of this story is not really Sodom, it's Lot. The story follows Lot the entire time. And Lot displays what I would call, at best, a mixed bag of obedience. Mixed bag of obedience. I mean, he starts off well. He offers, insistently offers, hospitality to these strangers who show up that no one else in the square would even think to offer. That word insisting is interesting in the original language. You can translate it manhandle. In other words, he twisted their arms like, you need to come to my house. He was insistent about giving them a safe place to stay for the night, which is great. But then when he feeds his guests, it's funny, he actually gives them what Abraham joked about giving them, just a little bit of bread. I mean, comparatively with what Abraham laid out as a feast, Lot gave them a hurried offering of unleavened bread. But then on the good side, he courageously faces the crowd and their demands to use the visitors to quench their sexual desire. And this is not just people standing around talking. This is an aggressive, violent mob. We're told that they continue to pressure Lot so much that they may have broken down the door. And Lot faces that crowd. That's a heroic moment. But it's followed right up by what? Lot offering his own daughters to the crowd as an alternative to sending out his guests. He goes outside, friends, don't do this wicked thing. Rape my daughters instead. I mean, just in that one line, he goes from doing something noble to doing something sick. It's a compromise. And actually, it's a compromise that would have benefited Lot in the long run, because if the people outside would have taken that compromise, his standing in the community would have gone up a notch. They would have said, oh, he is like us. He does know us. He's actually one of us. And it is so clear when you read the story, Lot desperately wanted to be in. He didn't want to be an outsider. When he calls them outside, he calls them friends. You could translate it brothers. And someone's saying, listen, I'm one of you. I want to be one of you, even though they treat him as an outsider still. Made me ask this question of myself, how much are we willing to compromise in order to be accepted by our own surrounding cultural cliques and groups? Lot was willing to compromise so much to be accepted by that crowd of people. In spite of the events of the night and the presence of these powerful visitors, Lot is still hesitant to leave the city. Isn't that crazy? It says that when he hesitated, he was still hesitant, even after the mob, even after the struck with blindness, even after the angels pull him in and say, listen, this place is going to catch fire, you need to get out. Even after all that, he still hesitates to stay where he is. You know what that reminded me of? Have you ever seen coverage on the news or the Weather Channel where there's an impending hurricane, and they interview the people who refuse to leave, even though there's an evacuation order? Crazy people. I'm not leaving. I've survived much more than this. I'm not sure why I have a southern accent right now, but... oh, probably because mostly that's a southern state. So that makes sense, right? But I mean, whether it's because they're so tied to their home and their possessions, they can't imagine leaving it during the storm. Or maybe they're just stubborn and believe that they will survive anything. And I look at them like I look at Lot. There's so many warnings about what is coming, and yet Lot, for some reason, is hesitant to leave that place. The place he so desperately wants to be accepted. And then lastly, he was told repeatedly to flee the city. They grasped him by the hand because he hesitated. Get out. And they said multiple times, flee the city. Go to the mountains. Don't go to anywhere else on the plain. Go all the way to the mountains so you won't be overtaken. And yet, Lot wants a compromise. I'll never make it to the mountains. So in other words, he's saying, oh, I doubt God's judgment of my speed. I know better. I'm never going to make it. Let me go to Zoar. And did you notice the thing about Zoar? It's small, right? It's a little town. As if he's saying, it can't be as bad as this stuff. Just let me go there. I think it's a reminder that Lot is unwilling to give up this city life, this culture that he was attracted to so long ago. Remember when Abraham and Lot split and he wanted to go to the cities on the plain? And if you remember, he pitched his tent near Sodom. The next time we saw him, he was living in Sodom. There's some sort of hold that it has on him, and he is so unwilling to let it go. Just let me go to Zoar. It's just a little city. It'll be okay. And funnily enough, they say, fine, just go. Just go. Obedience is never perfect. But it leads us to this last point. Grace is never deserved. Grace is never deserved. And we see it in Abraham. He doesn't make much of an appearance, but it's a powerful one at the end of the story. In spite of Lot's mixed bag of obedience and his hesitancy to leave Sodom, it is the faithfulness and the prayer of Abraham that leads to Lot being spared. We read it in verse 29. The Lord remembered Abraham and therefore rescued Lot. And I have to wonder, is this maybe the most important, significant theological insight of this entire story? If the story follows Lot and it ends here with Lot being rescued, but because God remembers Abraham. It reminded me this week that the reason for the shape of your life journey goes far beyond your own actions and decisions. Yes, those play a huge part in it, but I want to tell you that there are people who have probably been praying for you for a long time, who will continue to pray for you. I'm absolutely convinced to this day the only reason that I survived college relatively unscathed is because my grandparents prayed for me every day, and probably many more people. But I know that they would tell me when they would see me, we're praying for you every day. Yes, your life is shaped by the decisions you make, but it is also shaped by so much that is beyond that. Loving concern and insistent intercession are never wasted in God's economy. I have to believe that's what Abraham was all about. Loving concern for this nephew, kind of sort of son, Lot, and intercession. In my mind's eye, this, you're not going to find it in the Bible, but I can picture Abraham that entire night when Lot is back and forth with the angels, just praying in his tent. Intently interceding for that man that he loved so much. And I think that this portrait that we see of Abraham is most beautiful for this reason, because it foreshadows the picture of what Jesus has done for us. It's the faithful intercession of Jesus that saves us from our sin and our disobedience. God remembered Abraham, and therefore Lot was delivered. God remembers what Jesus has done, and therefore we are saved. If you think it's because of your own streak of obedience, I'm sorry. You're wrong. It's because the Lord looks at the life, the death, the resurrection of Jesus, and he remembers his Son, and therefore we receive grace and pardon and mercy that we have never been deserving of. So I want to finish with these three things for us to think about and consider as we finish our time together. First of all, which of the sins of Sodom are present in your life? Take some time and confess them to God now and be determined to leave them behind. Because I want to tell you, my friends, if you insist on remaining, you will perish. Your life will perish. If you insist on retaining the rhythms of sin in your life will suffer because of it. Which of those sins of Sodom might be present, and how can you bring them before God and leave? Secondly, pray for someone today you know who's in danger of soaking in the culture that surrounds him or her. Now listen, we're all called to be in the world but not of it. I think we all know and we recognize that, but maybe you know someone who is in the world and soaking in the world. Pray for them today. Be that insistent intercession like Abraham was for Lot. And then lastly, if nothing else, take a moment. Thank God that the gift of his grace and mercy are completely undeserved, and yet we receive them with joy and thankfulness and celebration. So take a moment or two if you want to pray. Close your eyes, bow your head, read through the words on the screen, whatever it is that allows the Spirit to penetrate into your heart to speak to you today, a word that may just be for you, and then I will close us with prayer in just a moment. Father, today we're thankful to be back in the life and times of Abraham, and even if it means walking through difficult scenes like this one, but we know that they're there for a reason. They're there to continue to teach us today. So God, if there are any sins that maybe have been lurking around unnoticed that you've brought to light to our minds today, we confess them and ask that you would help us to be people who are pure. Not only sexually pure, but God, as we look at our lives and ask if there is pride there, if there's arrogance there, if there's pompous superiority that's there, if there is a lack of care for those around us who need, bring us that conviction today. We pray for those who may be soaking in their culture, who maybe have been deeply entrenched for long enough that they may consider the judgment of God to be a joke. God, we intercede for them today and ask that you would move in their lives in some way so they could continue to hear your voice, even if it's just faintly for now. And we celebrate together the beautiful gift of salvation, of reconciliation. Your grace is absolutely undeserved. Your forgiveness and your mercy, we could never earn them or expect them, and yet we receive them with thanksgiving. We pray all of this today, Jesus, in your name. Amen.